You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, exploring space can be awe-inspiring but expensive. We'll talk to an aerospace engineer who thinks the romance of space has practical benefits and says spending money on space research helps advance society as a whole.
Right now, for many urban areas, retail food options can be tough to come by. A lack of investment can create food deserts where people without their own vehicles may have to travel miles for fresh produce and meat.
In the Walker's Point neighborhood of Milwaukee, people have recognized the need for a new grocery store for years. After lobbying city officials, showing up at public meetings, and gathering signatures, their efforts are paying off. Cermak Fresh Market will soon open in Walker's Point.
Victor Ray is the former president of the Walker's Point Association, a group connecting residents with businesses and city officials to improve the community. Victor, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Well, for those of us who haven't been there, can you give us a sense for what the Walker's Point neighborhood is like?
Well, Walker's Point is a very diverse neighborhood, an inclusive neighborhood, and it's a neighborhood that is a great mixture of residents and now some of the best foodies in the city of Milwaukee. Walker's Point is an eclectic neighborhood. It's a culmination of many different races, many different cultures of people. And what I like about Walker's Point is, as Walker's Point started many, many years ago, it started the same way as it's ending today, with that diversity of cultures and a very exciting neighborhood to be in.
It sounds like there has been one thing that Walker's Point was missing, and that would have been easy access to a neighborhood grocery store. So what kind of options were there for people who wanted to, you know, buy their groceries for the week in the neighborhood?
Well, I was president of the Walker's Point Association, and the most common thing that people talked about was that if you were to go to a grocery store, it was a journey. It was a destination. You could not walk. You could not ride your bike. The nearest grocery store was 2.5 miles to 3 miles away for full-service grocery. And so we needed a supermarket in the Walker's Point area. So I took it upon myself, with the help of our Walker's Point Association, to try to find an interested party, if you will, to come and open a grocery store. The problem was that a lot of the mainline grocery stores that I talked to and showed property to said that there wasn't enough residents around for them to be profitable, if you will, in the general area. Well, I disagreed with that. And I wrote letters. I called supermarkets. I drove them around to different places in our area, and we found one good location. And so what I tried to do is talk those people into putting something there, because our population in Walker's Point actually goes up during the day, and the people who are leaving work could possibly shop there. And I was looking for something that wasn't so much a big mainline supermarket as much as something that could offer organic foods, fresh foods, things that would draw people to shop in Walker's Point as opposed to going to Bayview or to downtown Milwaukee.
I suppose if you're one of these supermarket retail outfits, you look at this area and you are trying to eyeball it for potential customers. And on the one hand, you see a lake, and then you also see some industrial area and businesses. That must have made it a little bit of a harder sell.
It was. But you have to realize I'm not in that market. I'm in the market of customer service to our people and making Walker's Point an area where people can live, work, and play. And the supermarket was one of those key areas where a person could not live, because we didn't have what was needed for them. They could go to the gas stations or to the convenience markets, but they were going to pay a little bit more than what they could pay in other places. Being a diverse neighborhood that we were, a lot of our people in Walker's Point area in the near south side don't have the kind of money that is needed to be able to spend whatever you wanted to on groceries. And so I was also looking at ways in which to help those that are less fortunate be able to afford to stay in our area. Most of a lot of our people in the Walker's Point area don't have cars, so they need to use public transportation or bicycles or walk.
There was real persistence involved in this effort. As someone who's been through this, and there may be other parts of Milwaukee, other cities that are facing a food desert and some obstacles, what do you think was key to channeling that persistence into real action?
I think the key was that you had to keep the people interested in the end objective. And that was, we needed something to be able to sustain life in Walker's Point. And a supermarket was key to doing that. A supermarket was key to attracting more people to live in our area. The supermarket was key to be able to feed our families. And the supermarket was key to attract other communities to come to Walker's Point to shop.
So have you heard from people about how they're feeling about this?
I am receiving anywhere from 50 to 100 emails from people all over Walker's Point, some I don't even know, who are saying, congratulations, your baby is birthing.
And so it feels pretty good. Do you think this is going to have the effect you hope for, that it would turn Walker's Point into a place where people could work and play, but also live and do it in a healthy way?
I think it's beginning. If I was still in Walker's Point, the next thing I would be fighting for is a hospital. There was a hospital at one time where Rockwell Automation is today in their in their parking lot right behind them. In fact, that was St. Luke's Hospital, run by a group of nuns in that area. And Aurora Healthcare actually showed me the documentation and the pictures of that small little hospital was there. In fact, I lived next door to where that hospital was at one time, and I had restored the Bruce House. Very proud of that community today. When I moved into the Walker's Point community, it was a community that was iffy. It was a community that was drug-ridden. It was a community of homes that were mostly rented, where landlords didn't take care of property. But we energized that area. We got the Home Depots of the world to give us discount cards to give to the neighbors so that they could buy plants at a discounted price. We took Supervisor Peggy West, took it upon herself with us in the Walker's Point Association, and 2 to 3 times a year, we walked the streets of Walker's Point picking up trash. It became contagious. And the residents melded together to make that community what it is today.
Victor, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
That was Victor Ray, former president of the Walker's Point Association. He was with us to talk about an effort by residents of Walker's Point to attract a much-needed grocery store to the neighborhood. Putting a person on the moon is still widely considered one of humanity's greatest accomplishments. Today, a manned mission to Mars and even building a colony there are being talked about as maybe our next great adventures. Space exploration can be awe-inspiring and romantic, but is it worth it?
Critics say that while problems like poverty, homelessness, and disease persist here on Earth, money spent on space exploration is better used elsewhere. But our next guest says that the romance of space has real benefits of its own, inspiring people to pursue science and advancing society as a whole.
Earl Kyle is with us now. He's an aerospace engineer and physicist whose designs have flown on Apollo's manned moon mission, Skylab, and the SR-71 Blackbird. Earl, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. My pleasure to be here.
Well, you remember in your piece, you recall being in the VIP section, seeing the Apollo 11 mission blast off into space. Can you share with us what that moment was like for you?
Yeah, it was very incredible. I was 2.8 miles away. They said if we were a little bit closer, the sound would have killed us. And when the thing finally did take off, I actually cried. I had tears in my eyes, and it was the most incredible thing I've ever experienced. People who were much further away, like some protesters, like 15 miles away, they were equally awed by it momentarily and forgot their being negative about the program. So it's quite an experience. And I've been to the same spot to see a shuttle take off, and it's nothing as the Apollos were. There was this nothing as big like that has ever been launched since.
What do you think it is about what you call and others call the romance of space that can cause even critics, even people who think maybe money would be better spent here on Earth solving problems like poverty and homelessness, cause even critics to lose themselves, at least for a moment, in the awe of it?
Well, I think it has to do with inspiration. There's an astronaut from Apollo 7, Walt Cunningham, who said, "If you can spend all the money you want on education, but if you can't inspire a kid, you're just wasting your money on it." And so everybody's got a different hot button, and there are a few people who just get turned on with the romance of that. And the benefit is that a lot of the things that had to be invented that didn't exist before to make it happen eventually get spun off to help the rest of mankind, and I can cite tons of examples of that, that the payoff has been much more than what it actually cost to make the moon landing.
And that has been an argument that has been made over the years, not just now, but, you know, going back, including those Apollo missions that you were talking about, that there were critics who said, look, we need to spend our money here on Earth where we have real problems that need to be solved in space. Space costs a lot of money. But you're saying it doesn't have to be an either or kind of equation.
Yeah, that's right. If you actually look carefully at the numbers, the amount of money that was spent on the Apollo program, if you convert it into today's dollars, spread out over the eight-year period of it, was less than what we spend on cosmetics, for example, every year, or what we spend on pet food and so forth. And one can, I'm not saying I'm against all those things, but you can say that are those as equally important to poverty? So you get spinoffs from the moon and the space programs or a Mars mission, but you don't get the same kind of a spinoff from buying pet food. That's the argument I'm making, essentially.
Can you tell us about what some of those spinoffs from the space program might be?
Yeah, there have been new dialysis techniques for kidney patients. One of my sons has had that problem and had to be on that for 8 years. There have been a lot of medical improvements, new technologies on the solar cells. And, of course, we're always worried about the environment and greenhouse gases and things like that from fossil fuels, and there's a big move towards solar. The development of that technology came out of the Apollo program. There's over 6,000 different spinoffs that directly flowed into our economy with new inventions. Everybody's almost has a smartphone with a camera in it. The digital chip that's in there came from the Apollo program. And I could just go on and on. We just don't have time for that. But I allude to some of that in the article that was published last February in my response to the other one.
And another issue that educators and, you know, other people are tackling is that there is an involvement gap for women and for people of color when it comes to STEM fields, science and engineering and math, all of those. Is there something about space that might draw more people in, broaden that base that you wouldn't see somewhere else?
Yeah, I think so. I ran a program some years ago at the request of my alma mater, the University of Minnesota, to try to help get more women and minorities into the technical program there, and also to help retain them. And it was really hard, and nothing's really changed much. We still have less than 4% of women in these kinds of fields, and minorities about the same percentage. Even if there wasn't a space program, there have been systemic things that have gone on historically that pretty make it hard for people who you typically don't see in those professions, like in Silicon Valley. It's even worse there. It's like about 1% minorities and females in those professions out there. So put that attack on the space program is really not where the problem lies. If there wasn't a space program, we'd still have those problems. One of the astronauts on shuttle, Mae Jemison, when she was 16 years old, she went to Stanford, and she's black, and she's female, and she's in their classes studying physics and so forth. And every time she'd raise her hand, she couldn't get the recognition from the professor. When a white person moved, the male would raise his hand, then he'd get recognized from the same question. So those kind of problems have always existed, and to knock the space program as being the culprit is really going off target historically.
Well, what do you think is the antidote to that?
Well, we're making some progress, but the more publicity that comes. First of all, there was a book that was written many years ago of a study globally. Only about 5% of the general population in any culture are really the nerd type or the techie types. And I, for example, classify myself as one of them. And I would have paid them to work on the Apollo program. That's how much I loved it. I wanted to do it ever since I was a kid in eighth grade, and long before there was a space program. I got a lot of flack from that because when I was inspired by a magazine article, nothing had been put up in space, and nobody believed that we would put anything up, let alone human beings. And, of course, eventually they were proven to be wrong. There have always been naysayers, and there's always been the weirdos who come along and the dreamers and say, gee, I think this could be done. And then when it does happen, a lot of spinoffs come along that wouldn't have happened as fast that have benefited all of mankind.
We're talking with Earl Kyle right now, an aerospace engineer and physicist, talking about how space exploration inspires people to pursue careers in science and, he says, spurs inventions that benefit people far beyond the launch pad. And Earl, I want to ask you about Elon Musk and his ventures to privatize space exploration, for instance, colonize Mars. This guy's dreaming big. What do you think about that shift of having a private entity, a single person, fund this kind of work?
Yeah, well, I think that it's important. First of all, he's not the richest guy that's trying to pull this off. It's just recently, this morning, Paul Allen, the co-founder of Microsoft, announced a gigantic airplane that he's developed that will have hanging onto the belly of the thing rockets that can launch a cluster of satellites to make cell phone coverage in poor countries more available. There are a lot of people. Jeff Bezos, the founder of Amazon.com, has a private rocket company called Blue Origin, and he's doing the same thing, taking his own money to try to bring people up into space. It was once said that when the Apollo astronauts first looked back on that blue marble floating in the blackness of space, if we could bring these warring leaders of the world up into space and let them see our small, fragile planet, it would do a lot toward world peace. So I'm all for everybody that has the wherewithal or the guts or the spirit or the passion to make this happen to do it, because the more the merrier, as far as I'm concerned.
Are you concerned at all that it would turn space into the domain of the rich?
No, I don't think that at all. I think that if there wasn't a space program, and let me give you an example, you go back to the late 1800s with the robber barons and the railroad barons and so forth, where you had this big income inequality, that sort of thing is cyclical, and it has happened over and over again in history, and we're moving into it right now, and there's a lot of flack about that, but you can't blame it on the space program. And once Musk, with his ideas, and Bezos, with his ideas of reusable rockets to bring that cost down, this will be a big breakthrough where eventually it'll benefit all those who can't raise the money to be the first wave to go. But eventually it will come down so that others will benefit as well, and if they want to take a ride, they can. And matter of fact, some companies are even talking about having a raffle of things, so you can join a raffle and for a modest amount of money, they'll draw your name out of the hat, and you get to go along with essentially for free on a ride up to one of these suborbital or orbital tourist flights.
That makes me want to ask you, you've been designing stuff for space for a lot of your career. Did you ever want to go?
Yeah, but now I'm too frail and old to go along for the ride. But I'm encouraging everybody that that's healthy. My youngest son is in the business, and he might go someday and be one of the first to set foot on Mars.
You know, we were talking about Silicon Valley and the people there getting involved in space. And, you know, in Silicon Valley, there is the motto right now to fail fast. In space, it has been to fail publicly, really publicly, which can be hard to swallow if you're thinking about the money lost, sometimes the lives lost. Do you think that that has been a setback when it comes to the space program, the fact that it's so public?
I'm not sure I caught the first part of your point there. Can you rephrase that?
Well, when a space shuttle, for instance, if you look at Elon Musk, some of his rockets have blown up.
The Challenger
disaster, big public failures in the space program. Has that been a setback?
Yeah, it has. But the people who are really in for it, I remember when Ronald Reagan got on the television after the shuttle disaster. He said eloquently that we should just keep on going in honor of those who gave their lives. I think of Krista McAuliffe, the first teacher in space on the first shuttle explosion. That spawned Challenger centers all across the nation where young people can go and learn about science and technology and so forth. The closest one is down near the Milwaukee, Chicago area, by the way, for those in your vicinity.
And Earl, as we wrap up, almost out of time, but what do you think is the next frontier in space that people can be excited and inspired by?
Oh, I want to see men on Mars. I just hope I live long enough to see it happen, or more women, too, by the way. And when I say men, I mean humans on Mars. That's our next frontier.
Earl, thanks a lot for joining us.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for calling.
That was Earl Kyle, an aerospace engineer and physicist, talking with us there about how space exploration can inspire people to go for those careers in science. And it also, he says, spurs innovation and inventions that benefit everybody.
Coming up, we'll talk to a lawmaker who wants to reform the state's school voucher program. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time.
The debate over public schools, school choice, and voucher programs has been contentious for years now. The camp arguing in favor of vouchers say parents know what schools work best for their kids and they should have a say. Critics say that school vouchers have been siphoning funds from public school districts and place students in those schools at a severe disadvantage.
Last week, we talked to two guests who argued in favor of an expanded school voucher program in the state, saying that it would greatly benefit students, especially in rural areas. But our next guest has been advocating for reforms to the program for some time and has introduced legislation that would dial back vouchers and put more resources into public schools.
Representative Jonathan Brostoff of Milwaukee joins us now. He's a Democrat representing Wisconsin's 19th Assembly District. Representative Brostoff, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you, Rob, and thank you, Veronica, for having me on.
Well, tell us about this legislation. It sounds like it does a couple things. Dials back vouchers, puts more into reducing class sizes, more resources in certain public schools. Spell it out for us.
Exactly. Yeah, that's exactly right. You know, you kind of hit the nail on the head. You know, Wisconsin has had a really long, proud tradition of strong public schools. And unfortunately, powerful interests have been working for decades to undermine that system and to siphon resources away from our public schools and, quite frankly, to line some pockets. They've also worked to end a successful experiment that we started here called SAGE, which was also around 20 years ago, and that was aimed at, among other things, reducing classroom sizes in schools that were having challenging circumstances for K through third grade. So the Public Education Reinvestment Act, or PERA, will bring back the tradition of strong public schools and put an end to the failed voucher program that has been taking money and resources out of public schools for over a quarter of a century with little to no benefit. And I know by pushing for this legislation, I'm going up against some very powerful interests who have invested a lot of money in the politics of this state. And they might be listening right now and planning against me, but, well, one, they don't scare me, and two, most importantly, regardless of how much money they want to put into either buy or scare politicians, we have a responsibility to fight for what's best for the future of our children. And that means reducing classroom sizes and ending this failed program that has been hurting our public schools for so long.
Now, you say the voucher program, the choice programs in Wisconsin are failed programs. There's a lot of research on these. It seems like a lot of it is in the middle territory, some maybe improvement in performance for some kids, some kind of on a par. Failure, is that an overstatement?
That's a great question. Yeah, it's interesting, you know, Rob, because I'll tell you something. I'm from Milwaukee my whole life, and I went to public schools. Not only that, but I'm actually of the age, I'm 33 now. So when I was in school, I remember the voucher experiment starting off, and I remember the promises that were made. And in fact, I remember my debate partner, Ife Lutunji, and I had this exact subject. You know, I think it was at Hartford Elementary School where we were debate partners. And at that time, the subject was if it's legal and constitutional to be able to pay for private religious schools with public dollars. But when the debate was kind of starting strong off back then, the issue was, well, we're going to have this amazing program that's going to, you know, flip the lives of these, you know, inner city children, and it's going to be a complete education revolution, and we're going to do so much more with so much less, and this is just going to give the opportunity for everyone to go to these private schools. And that was the initial claim. So their claim was not that we're going to keep par and siphon all these resources away, because if that was the case, then we shouldn't be taking resources away from public schools, which has increased class sizes and hurt their efforts for shrinking the achievement gap, et cetera. They would just be reinvesting in public schools at that point. We could make it stronger. What they said, what they've been pushing, is that we're going to have revolution. They keep, at this point, using the terminology of an experiment because they don't want to say, well, it's been over a quarter of a century, and they still haven't done anything with it. In fact, for a long time, they didn't even release the information of how the students are doing. So now we finally got it. We're seeing, well, there is, like you said, there's not a big difference. There's no revolution going on. And now the real culprit, this is about lining certain people's pockets and pushing an extreme ideological agenda. And another example of the failure is that from 1991 to 2015, 41% of the schools participating in the voucher program closed their doors to students. These are schools like Life Skills Academy that are taking the money, closing down halfway through, leaving the students out in the streets, you know, going back to the public schools and having a further burden placed on these public schools and taking the money and buying new cars, going to Florida, whatever. Also, another example is from 2004 to 2014, the state paid $139 million to these failed voucher schools. So now what we're looking at is giving even more money to this program. You know, if the budget goes through the way Walker wants it, roughly $1,000 to $1,700 more dollars in state funding per student than their public school counterparts, is going to be pushed through. So this is kind of a backwards paradigm. And this is also importantly in the context of a program, an experiment that did work. The SAGE program worked. Reducing classroom sizes to an 18-to-1 ratio does work. We have the data on it. So what my bill would do was it would actually expand the program that has worked, that has shown what can be successful, and what parent across the state of Wisconsin wouldn't want to have more individual attention paid to their student. This is the program that works, so we want to expand that, and we just want to stop funding this parallel system that's not as accountable, that's not producing the results they promised, and that is siphoning resources away and hurting our public schools.
Talking to Democratic State Representative from Milwaukee, Jonathan Brostoff, about voucher schools, he is proposing legislation that would dial back on them and put more money into increasing class sizes, especially in low-income school districts. So what?
Decreasing class sizes.
Decreasing class sizes. Thank you. An important misspeak there. Decreasing class sizes in public schools, especially in low-income districts. So if your legislation passed, tall order, you're in the minority party, but if it were passed, what would happen to voucher schools and choice schools that exist now?
Well, they would be phased out. Again, unlike the irresponsible voucher school directors, in many cases, or executive directors or profiteers, we wouldn't just leave the kids high and dry. We'll let it phase out naturally so that they can be reintegrated and build the capacity in our public schools.
And then what would you do to restore that SAGE program?
Can you elaborate on that question?
What would your legislation do when it comes to funding the SAGE program on class sizes in schools?
So it doesn't, what the legislation I'm proposing doesn't exactly restore the SAGE. In fact, it expands upon it. Again, we've already shown that the K through third SAGE program has worked. So this would be expanding it to K through 12. This is, you know, shown that, you know, one big issue, unfortunately, that we wrestle with in Wisconsin is a significant achievement gap between African-American and white students. So the SAGE program was pretty clear, showing that these lower classroom sizes, the more individual attention, helped all students, but especially helped reduce that gap. So we want to take that and expand it, not just reinstate the SAGE that the repubs have been working on dismantling, but in fact expand it K through 12. And, you know, another quick example of why we need to do this, again, as a MPS student, I remember my freshman year at Milwaukee High School of the Arts over off of Highland, there was a class where I sat down and, you know, I remember thinking very clearly that there's way too many students in here for me to get the kind of individual attention that I wanted for a particular assignment that was going on that day. And I remember very clearly having that thought. But that was back when I was in high school and I was a freshman. Now we're talking about, you know, a situation where it's not just 32 or 33 kids per class. Some of the teachers I've spoken with have said that when everyone shows up, you're talking about 41, 42, 43 kids per classroom. And we're not physically expanding the size of the buildings. And again, we're not putting more teachers in. We're just sardining more students in, and that's totally inappropriate. So one of the side effects that's happened from the failed voucher school program is that it's taken so much resources away from our public school. We need to start rectifying that, and that's why we want to expand it, not just reinstate, as you suggested, K through third SAGE, but we want to take the program and try it K through 12th grades.
We're talking to Representative Jonathan Brostoff, Democrat representing the Milwaukee area. He's joining us today to give us his thoughts on the state school voucher program. He would like to dial it down, put more into public schools.
And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Do you think the state school voucher program is helping or hurting families? And what changes would you like to see school districts make throughout the state? Maybe, in this case, decreasing class sizes. Give us a call at 800-642-1234 or leave a comment on the Central Time Facebook page.
We continue our conversation now about school vouchers in Wisconsin with Representative Jonathan Brostoff. He's a Democrat representing Wisconsin's 19th Assembly District. He's from Milwaukee. With us to talk about school vouchers in Wisconsin, he wants them to go away, the school choice program as we have it, and he'd like to put more investment into public schools.
And you can join us at 800-642-1234. If you're a parent, what are your thoughts on the state's voucher program? If you're a teacher or an administrator, what impact has the voucher program had on your school district? You can call us at 800-642-1234 or leave a comment over on the Central Time Facebook page.
Let's go right to our callers. We've got Marie on the line in Green Bay. Marie, hi.
Hi. I agree with the representative that we need to look at reducing the number of voucher programs. I am a huge proponent of public schools, so you know that I have a side on it, but I'm also a public school educator for 31 years. And the biggest thing that I am seeing happen with the voucher program is they are saying that they're successful, but they're really truly not testing the kids who are getting vouchers with the exact same state testing that we are being required under the state report card to be taking. Our students take the Badger exam. I teach third grade. Our kids take over 12 hours to take this test. And there is no test that is being given to these kids in voucher schools to say, are they truly performing at the same levels they do? I am in a high poverty school. We have 87% poverty in my school. And I just feel that a lot of this program is being built that we're helping low-income families, but they're truly not showing if it's helping low-income families when I see what we are striving for in the school that I work with to really meet the needs of our kids.
Marie, thanks for the call. Representative Brostoff, do you see this as a problem? No apples-to-apples comparisons between choice schools and public schools?
Yeah, absolutely. Marie, you know, is dead on there. And I also just want to say thank you, Marie, for your dedication and for your service. I have definitely heard that sort of thing over and over and over, that this accountability, the standards aren't there. And for a long time, we weren't getting any information out of those schools. But on the flip side, you know, I think it's not just enough to stop this kind of out-of-control voucher program. We also have to work on reinvesting in our public schools directly. So a school like Marie's in Green Bay, I would like to see a classroom ratio of no more than 18 students to one teacher. And if there's specialized training that could be helpful, you know, offering that as well to help with the achievement gaps that Wisconsin, unfortunately, has suffered under. So it's really got to be kind of two parts of the component. We have to stop the bad, and we have to push the good, and we have a great program that Wisconsin's already proven to work. Let's expand that.
Marie, thanks for the call. We'll go next to Jan with us in Milwaukee. Jan, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to bring up, Jan?
My comment is I've had experience in all kinds of schools. I grew up going to public school until high school, then college preparatory. Then I taught at public school for 18 years, and now I'm in a voucher school. And my biggest concern with the voucher schools is there's a real lack of resources. At least the school I'm in, is the lack of discipline. It is a K-12. I mean, I'm in a room that has had no heat a lot of the winter.
Oh, my gosh.
But no airflow. Like, I'm in an interior room, no windows, no airflow at all. But my biggest concern is for the students.
Oh, my gosh.
And they, as far as, like, the STEM classes are really lacking. There's no AP courses. I teach the lower school kids, but last year I taught with the upper school kids, and there are no science materials. They're short books. The kids are not getting chemistry. They're not getting physics.
So, Jan, thanks for the call. So, Jan's saying she's teaching in a voucher school and seeing this under-resourcing there. What do you make of that?
Yeah, first of all, Jan, please feel free to contact me afterwards. I'd love to chat, 608-266-0650, and we definitely need to do something about that. You know, we have laws about, you know, the temperatures that you have to have in a classroom, and I don't want any children to be put in a dangerous situation like that. But aside from that, unfortunately, her story, although it's quite unfortunate, it's not unique. I've heard that from many friends of mine who, you know, quite frankly, have taught at voucher schools. You know, a friend of mine, Shyla, had a similar experience where she was looking for work, very passionate about education. She worked at this school and saw the kind of horrors going on behind the scenes. And really, I mean, that's what happens. And it gets so bad that one way or another, they have to get shut down. And then the students who are in these schools, who are having these, you know, inappropriate temperatures, who don't get enough books, who aren't getting their needs met, the money's going to be often to the executive director, to the top of the person. They're fleeing, taking the money, lining their pockets. The students are left to hang out to dry, and then these students who, you know, have to get reintegrated to these public schools because public schools take everyone. They don't pick and choose. They educate everyone. But oftentimes the students that come through, one, the money doesn't follow. I'm sure everyone listening to this is familiar with Third Friday. But two, are sometimes at a disadvantage because they weren't getting the quality education that the public school counterpart would have been offering. And that's why you've seen so many schools shutting down. You know, I referred to the 41%, but that just sounds like a statistic. But you think about it, that's nearly half of the schools from 1991 to 2015, and that's a lot of students that you're leaving out in the dust.
Jan, thanks for that call. We're talking to Representative Jonathan Brostoff, Democrat from Milwaukee. He's in the state assembly talking about school vouchers. He's sponsoring legislation that would end Wisconsin's voucher program over time and put more investment, expand programs that lower class sizes in public schools. Back to our callers now, Jim on the line in Franklin. Jim, hi.
Hi. I am glad we have the opportunity to mention this. With voucher schools, if they have a student who might be disruptive, and very difficult to handle. The voucher schools, just send them right back to MPS.
Now, exactly.
The problem with this is that the money that they accepted at the beginning of the school year does not follow that disruptive student to Milwaukee Public Schools. So now we have to deal with a student that does have some social problems, and we don't have the money to work with that student. The second thing with voucher school is the fact that they do not take any exceptional education students, that MPS has to provide the education for those students. In other words, a teacher has to be sent to the voucher school to deal with a student who has special needs. And again, that's money that is coming from MPS to service a system that is not particularly adequate.
Jim, thanks for calling in and sharing your experience. Since we're a little short on time, I want to get to another caller, Representative Brostoff. I want to bring on Scott in Jefferson now. Scott, hi.
Hello.
Hey, Scott.
Thank you for taking my call. Representative, what is your reaction or your response to the study that was published within the last, 3 to 4 months by the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty? And the study result has been promoted by Cullen Roth, who is a fellow at this organization.
Sure.
And within his study, whatever, they've done some econometric modeling where they've removed the factors, whatever, within the individual to provide an apples-to-apples comparison. And what their study results, whatever, show, what they claim is that voucher and charter schools put out a better student and a more well-prepared student than the public schools do. What's your reaction to that study?
That is a great question, and thank you very much for bringing it up. In fact, they have kind of been on a tour. They were on the show a couple weeks ago, and I'll tell you this, for government efficiency, it took two highly paid private sector individuals to cover an issue that one government sector worker can do. So there you go. But second of all, these guys are getting paid a ton of money, siphoned through the Bradley Foundation, and, you know, they pay for these think tanks, they pay for these studies, and if you can find an economist for sale, you can, you know, come up with anything that looks official, but is it peer-reviewed? Is it actual science? That's the real question. And when you look at the actual science of it, there's nothing that's been able to prove that this has been successful. What they're trying to do, and again, they still will refer to it as an experiment because they don't want to say that after 25 years it hasn't been successful. So what they want to do now, they've lined their pockets in Milwaukee, they've hurt Milwaukee public schools, now they want to take this statewide, and why we're hearing so much opposition is because people like their public schools in Wisconsin. Again, we've had a long, strong history of public education support in this state, and people don't want that to be attacked statewide. They don't want to see their schools get siphoned all these resources out of, and, you know, they have to pay people like Colin lots of money. He's probably listening. Hello, Colin. In order to advocate for them because they don't have grassroots support.
And we have to leave it there for now. Thanks to Representative Jonathan Brostoff, Democrat from Milwaukee, talking about school vouchers in Wisconsin.
Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, a guest tells us what's driving the cost of long-term care for seniors and what could help solve that problem.
We'll meet a Wisconsin woman who went sailing on the world's oceans to get an insight on the impact of climate change.
And on Food Friday, advice for great meals on a budget.
That and a look at the top Wisconsin news stories of the week, all coming up tomorrow here on Central Time.